Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We eat, we drink, we take prescription drugs, and almost all of that, from the food on your plate to the drugs on your shelf to the contact lenses in your eyes, even the cell phone in your pocket, is regulated by one federal agency. Tonight on Point, the government's number one consumer protection agency, journalist and historian Philip Hiltz on the rocky saga of the FDA. We begin tonight with the man in charge of the FDA. Before he took office last October, the Food and Drug Administration had gone almost 2 years without a commissioner at the helm. 39-year-old Mark McClellan is the agency's first head with degrees in medicine and economics. He took a job no one wanted and earned a quick reputation for shaking things up earlier. I spoke with the young FDA chief and asked him to outline the biggest challenges he's facing.
As you know, the FDA is responsible for regulating 80% of the nation's food supply, as well as assuring the safety and promoting the availability of better medications, and we also have other responsibilities as well. So our new responsibilities today include protecting the country against terrorism, both terrorist threats to the food supply, and making available better treatments in the event of a terrorist attack. It includes helping to make better medical treatments available without adding unnecessarily to health care costs. It includes protecting consumers from the various kinds of adverse events that can arise. So there are a whole range of issues that are more challenging to the agency, I think, than ever before.
Mark McClellan, you know, of course, the FDA is about a century old now. It's gone through different phases, times when it was well-positioned to face the challenges that it has to deal with, times when it was underfunded, times when it was under attack. How would you describe the FDA situation right now? Is it well-supported by the government? Is it well-supported with the budget it needs? Is it situated to do the job?
I'd say that right now the FDA has both the greatest challenges that it's ever faced as well as the greatest array of tools for dealing with those challenges. We regulate, again, more than 20% of the U.S. economy, and that's growing. And while our responsibilities are great, there has also been some very important legislation passed that gives us some new authorities to help protect the food supply, and we're taking steps to implement that right now.
This is on the terror front, to protect it from terrorist attacks.
This is on the terrorism front against potential threats to the food supply.
That is introducing disease or germs into that supply?
That's right, potentially contaminating food with anthrax, other agents of biological terrorism, chemical attacks and the like. You and your listeners probably saw some of the reports from Europe, for example, earlier this year about terrorist groups trying to develop the capacity to make ricin, which is a poison that can be added to foods. That's an example of the kind of new threats that the agency is facing. Also, on the medical side, there are more and better medical technologies available than ever before, and with the advent of biomedical engineering advances and breakthroughs in human genomics, the potential for unprecedented medical progress in the years ahead, and we need to meet those challenges.
To a layperson, exactly that revolution in genomics and genetic engineering would seem to just open up a vast universe of opportunities, but also challenges for the FDA. Are you situated to deal with that, or are you going to be perpetually now criticized as the little hole through which everything has to pass, holding up progress?
I don't think that's going to be the case. We have play a critical role in assuring the safety and effectiveness of the medical treatments that people in this country use. And we take that responsibility very seriously. As you mentioned, we've got nearly a century of tradition of a strong dedication to protecting the public health as effectively as possible. We're having to change the way that we do our jobs. We are having to keep up with rapid changes in medical technology, but we've got a lot of new initiatives underway to help us do that.
How do you balance regulation and consumer protection with corporate interests? I mean, they are enormous on the other side of this, and the pressures on you must be great. When you come to work every day, Mark McClellan, how are you thinking about how to strike the right balance there?
I think sometimes the right answer is to find a more creative solution. The consumer perspectives that we get in the agency are very important, and we're not going to compromise our attention to safety and effectiveness for medical products. But by listening to the pharmaceutical industry, to medical experts, to other people who are developing new products, we can often find better ways to make sure that new drugs and other new medical products are safe and effective. And we can often do that more quickly and at a lower cost.
You've been both praised and criticized for trying to streamline that approval process on new drugs in particular. Can you streamline this without putting consumer health at risk?
We think that we can, and we've got some new resources that we're putting into that thanks to new user fees on the industry. We've also taken some steps to try to find better ways to use the latest science, new statistical techniques, new biomedical breakthroughs, so that we can better understand what might make drugs unsafe and what might make them effective for certain kinds of patients.
With all the scientific breakthroughs going on out there, is it possible anymore for one agency to stand in the middle of the stream and keep an eye on everything? When Americans go to the drug counter or to the grocery store shelf, can they now, will they in the future be able to feel confident that these foods and drugs are really thoroughly vetted before they're on sale?
Tom, the drugs in the United States are the safest in the world. Our rates of counterfeit drugs, impurities, and so forth are lower than in any other country. Our food supply is about the safest in the world as well. Rates of foodborne illness are low, and they've been going down. So we've got a tremendous tradition to uphold here, and we're going to continue to do it.
And do you feel that the current administration is really behind you? It's asked again and again whether the FDA has the resources it needs to really do the job. People say, no, if you just continue to hold tight on the budget, it's not going to be able to do the job. What's your assessment?
I think the assessment should be based on actions that we've seen. And last year, the FDA got the biggest expansion in its budget and the biggest increase in the number of personnel in the agency in, I think, a generation. We added more than 800 new staff to help us with our food safety and security responsibilities. We are adding new staff now with our additional resources to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of medical products. So the agency is larger than it's ever been. Our budget of $1.6 billion is higher than it's ever been. So we are bringing new tools to bear on our challenges. Now, the challenges are getting tougher, but we're trying to rise to the occasion.
Mark McClellan, as you know, the challenges are so tough that it wasn't exactly easy to fill the seat that you're sitting in now. You're 39 years old, and you've picked up this challenge. Why did you do it?
Is a wonderful job. It presents opportunities to make a positive difference in the lives of all Americans. It brings the best science to bear on helping to take those steps to protect and promote the public health. And most importantly, it's an opportunity to run an agency with a great tradition of dedication to public service, dedication to using the best available science to fulfill its critical public health mission, and some terrific people to work with. I am enjoying every day of work. It is a challenge every day, but with all of the allies inside the agency and the public's respect for what we do, it makes it a lot easier.
Mark McClellan, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Mark McClellan is head of the FDA. He spoke with me earlier from FDA headquarters in Rockville, Maryland. For almost a century, the Food and Drug Administration has been the thin membrane between boisterous business and America's health. In 1906, President Theodore Roosevelt signed the Pure Food and Drug Act, which gave birth to the FDA, America's oldest consumer protection agency. It's been a tumultuous century, from bad meat and thalidomide to genetically modified foods and ephedra. The FDA has been accused of being a hapless, impotent sentinel safeguarding America's health. It's been accused of holding up the march of progress. But look carefully, says our guest tonight. The FDA is a much maligned watchdog, he says, the last defense against big business and political interests that have tried to defang it. Now, a whole new universe of challenges are moving into the FDA's sticky spot between government, commerce, and consumer, between business and your health. Do you trust what's on your grocer's shelf, what's on the label, what's in the drugs? Are you confident that the government is looking out for your best interests? Can you imagine a world without the FDA, where anything goes in the bottle? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Philip J. Hiltz, author of Protecting America's Health, the FDA, Business, and 100 Years of Regulation. He's also a former health affairs and science writer for The Washington Post and The New York Times. Good evening and welcome, Philip Hiltz.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Philip Hiltz, you've painted a huge mural here, and a really fascinating one, of all the ups and downs, ins and outs of a century of the FDA. But I would love it if you'd take us back before we get there to paint a picture of American commerce and American consumption in the long years before the FDA. What did it look like before we had this kind of regulation and oversight?
Well, it was kind of interesting because for thousands of years, we had a kind of a stable level. We had a few drugs, a few techniques. Life expectancy was about age 36. That's all you could expect to get. But then in the 19th century, things changed dramatically. From a handful of drugs, we went up to thousands and thousands of quack drugs and crazy drugs and empty drugs with all kinds of – they were selling essentially by the shape of the bottle and the label and so on. This was all because that was when advertising wasn't invented, when national marketing was invented, when newspapers went from a few hundred newspapers to 1,500 daily newspapers, and more than half of their pages were filled with these ads. And at the same time, you had the food was being taken from local communities. A farmer would bring it to the local market. Now it was being taken, put on a train, sent to a big city. And so you had deterioration in food. And to cover the deterioration, they put on chemicals, they put on colorings and all this. Of course, untested. They were using formaldehyde to preserve things. And people were eating that. So it was really getting to be quite a mess.
What you're describing, in a way, is the industrial age moving full strength into the realms of food and medicine, Chicago emerging as a big hub and shipping meat and other food all over the country, and I guess industrialization leading to more drugs as well, or simply more demand for drugs, more expectation in those late 19th century years that there would be a cure for things.
Initially, it was the promotion only. It was for profit. There was no gain in medicine. It was simply they realized that they could sell these things based on hope. And there wasn't really much of anything to sell.
So that, just a real snake tonic business.
It was really quite enormous. Things didn't change, and we didn't get drugs that actually worked effectively for many diseases until beginning in about the end of the 1930s. It was really quite recent that that change happened.
So was there some kind of eureka moment for the country, for Teddy Roosevelt? What led that president to suddenly stand up and say, we've got to get a handle on this flow of material being consumed by our citizens?
Yeah, there was a kind of this rising tide. There was anger. The women's groups in each of the cities had staged protests, had gone to the health departments. They had regular speakers. Bills had been before Congress. There was a general rising anger. Then there was a series of articles in the major magazines in the country exposing some of these things. For example, there was Winslow's soothing syrup, which was to be given to infants who were colicky or crying or whatnot. Well, it turns out it worked very effectively because it had a lot of opium in it. The women didn't know that, and it turned out they killed thousands of infants that way by overdosing. Many of the drugs were 40 proof, 60 proof, and again, nobody knew what was in it.
Just a lot of alcohol.
Yeah. So these things were exposed during these articles. And so there was the debate in Congress. There were bills ready to go. And then the thing that really moved it was the one book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Mm-hmm. What year did that come out?
That was in 1905.
So right into Teddy Roosevelt's lap. That looked more at the food side of the equation, Phil Fields.
Yeah, it started out, Upton Sinclair went into the slaughterhouses hoping to write about the plight of the working man in because they were very low-paid jobs. They worked long hours. Mm-hmm. But what he described inside the plant is what really got to people. They were really revulsed because they talk about, for example, one cow slipped into a latrine and they pulled him out and put him up on the meat hook and sent him right along the line without even washing him off. The kind of way you would make sausage. There was even a story, and he swears it was true, that there was a man who fell into the vat of lard and became part of the lard. So it was really a horrible book, and people got quite angry. And so this was going on just when a bill was in Congress being debated, and that was the tipper.
So Upton Sinclair, looking at the plight of workers, ends up revealing too much information, but on the other hand, enough to get people fired up and lining up behind reform, a kind of reform they'd never seen before.
Yes, there was – at that time it was – nobody thought that business should be messed with. It was still quite an article of faith across the country that business should be absolutely free. Regulation was not something that one wanted to consider. But Roosevelt was really quite afraid at that point because we're also talking about time. This is the robber baron years had just finished. People were quite angry at the businesses. And so he thought in order to save capitalism from revolt, you had to civilize it. And his idea was regulation.
And there came the FDA. Philip Hilt, stand by. We'll be right back after a short break. We're talking tonight about the number one consumer protection agency in the nation, the FDA. Do you want a nitpicking FDA or a fast-tracking FDA? Do you trust what's on the label? Are you confident the government is looking out for your best interests in the supermarket and at the drugstore? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the number one consumer protection agency in the country, the FDA, and practically everything that goes into your body. My guest tonight is Philip Hiltz. He's author of the new book, Protecting America's Health, the FDA, Business, and 100 Years of Regulation. You can join the conversation as well. Why do you think the FDA is repeatedly a target for such harsh criticism? Does it deserve it or not? Can you imagine a world without the FDA when anything could be in the bottle? And is the FDA too stodgy or is it too permissive? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Philip Hiltz, you describe a century of this tension between business, commerce on the one hand, and government and consumer on the other. What was the response of American business in those first years when there's suddenly an agency that was tasked to regulate, and I suppose not nearly as effectively then as it might have later, but just the very idea that there would be this kind of oversight from the government of their trade in food and medicine?
They were very upset before the law. They were opposed to it. They made all kinds of threats. They thought it would be the end of the world as we know it. But it turned out right after the law was passed, they kind of liked it because it didn't have a lot of teeth, but it did do one thing. It made people feel like there was regulation and that these products maybe were not so bad. It did eliminate a few of the products. For example, the opium ones and the alcohol ones mm-hmm. either had to be labeled or taken off the market. So a few of the worst cases were gone. And so they felt like they were getting some credibility because of the law.
So in a way, regulation gave some stability and credibility, allowed growth in the food market, and especially in an era where, as you write, foods were being shipped in from all over the place. It wasn't all homegrown anymore.
Right. It was now shipped to major centers where it was processed, if you know, and of course, processed means it's now weeks old and so on. And so they had to cover up their problems.
Philip Hiltz, the FDA has often been seen as kind of under-equipped to do the job, but I was struck by your descriptions of just how rudimentary some of that early testing was. Could you share the story about the poison squad, the way these preservatives were first tested by the very early rendition of the FDA?
Yes, because they were shipping these foods a long way, they had to do something to preserve them. And they had half a dozen different chemicals they were using, including borax and formaldehyde, which are pretty rough chemicals. But they weren't tested. They were putting them in the foods. And so Harvey Wiley, who became the head of FDA.
He was an Indiana farmer, as I recall.
Yeah, Indiana farmer. He raised sorghum. And one day he walked off the farm, though, and went to college. And then mm-hmm. he became a chemist, and he never went back. But he wanted to try an experiment. He wanted to see if you fed people these chemicals in increasing doses, would they actually get sick? Would there be a problem? So what he did is he put an ad in the paper and said, we're going to have what we call our hygienic table, and we're going to have good food there, and then we're going to add these chemicals gradually, bit by bit, day after day. Mm-hmm. And do we have any volunteers? And it turned out there's a long line out the door. Everybody wanted to do this.
Just for free food?
I don't know what it was for. I guess sense of adventure, partly. And it was also written about in the newspapers, and they called it the Poison Squad. And people sort of liked the idea of it. It was a big adventure. So he picked the healthiest young men, many of them working in the agriculture department as clerks and potential chemists. And they did this. And so
they'd sit at his table every morning, every night, and eat food laced with essentially poison at some point.
Yeah, they took one poison at a time. They would sit the folks down, eat. They had to eat all their meals there. They had to collect all their waste and carry it around with them in bags, actually, until they got to the labs. And they would first eat food plain, and Wiley cooked it himself a lot of the times. And then they would put on a certain amount. Then the next day they would increase the amount and so on. It would go like that for weeks until they got to a point where the folks really got sick. Now, he did six different chemicals, and now three of them are banned, and the other three are regulated.
But out of that came a kind of baseline understanding of preservatives that would work and in what quantity they would work. Would be safe.
How much would it take to make you sick was the question. Mm. And it was more or less answered. It was not great science. We would do it somewhat differently today. But that was the first kind of experiment. It had never been done anywhere.
you know, it sounds so incredibly crude and yet courageous the way people stepped up to draw that baseline. It makes me wonder about where we stand now, Philip Hiltz, with genomics exploding, so many new kinds of substances, such sophisticated chemistry and manipulation of materials and biology of all kinds. When you look at the FDA today, do you see an agency that is budgeted, staffed, equipped to handle the challenges a century after its creation? Is it up to this flood of new and new kinds of materials, foods, and drugs headed toward Americans?
If it were up to me, I'd put more money into it. It's one of those issues about society. You look at what we spend our money on. You know, military is number one, and it's way outweighs everything else. And this budget of FDA is 1/250th of the Defense Department. So it seems to me that the priorities are not exactly straight there. I would probably do it differently. On the other hand, the agency we have is very active, and it's certainly the most successful in the world at testing drugs and making sure they're safe. They are safer here. The foods are safer here. The rest of the world has modeled their agencies after the FDA. So you don't want to say too much negative, but if it were me, I'd put more in.
Mark McClellan, the head of the FDA, was talking with us at the top of the hour. He described the FDA as now facing the greatest challenges it's ever faced. We didn't have time to dig into it with him, but what do you think he meant by that?
I think you mentioned it yourself when you're talking about genomics. This is when you get down to the level of genes in the body and you can manipulate genes and then you can drop chemicals into see how they affect them. It's possible to have really a very large number of drugs coming out of this research. So that's going to be a serious problem for the FDA. First of all, just the volume of them. Secondly, is there going to be some other kind of safety issue that we've never seen before? What is it going to mean to have these things out there? So it's a whole set of new problems.
And you've written about science and health for so long, years before you came out with this book. What is your sense, Philip Hiltz? Is the FDA, is the U.S. government holding the line on the notion of purity and food safety, or is it shifting, maybe even unintentionally, under the weight of all this new material, this new science? Is it gradually giving way, or does it really have a grip on where the line of safety is today?
It depends on the area. For example, herbal supplements and remedies. FDA used to regulate those. In 1994, the Congress took off all those regulations. And so that is now just a complete wild patch of weeds. I mean, no one knows what's in those bottles. They don't know whether they work or don't work, whether they're safe or not safe. There's no regulation that says they have to be tested. That's a big step backward. That's all the way back to the 19th century. So that area is not, it's not happening there. Mm-hmm. Veterinary drugs. There's a lot of worry about the drugs given to animals and then that get passed on to humans.
Antibiotics and so on.
Yeah. And what's going to happen there? That I don't think that's well controlled. When you talk about human drugs, the safety tests that are done before those are put out, they're really pretty good and almost as sophisticated as you can do now. You could test only in a certain number of folks, 3,000 or so. So there's things you're going to miss completely, and you'll find out when they get to the market. But there's almost no way right now of testing before they get to the market to be sure all those things are out. Of course, once in a while, the agency does make mistakes. They see some hazard, and they say, well, I'm not sure that's really there, and they put it out. And then all of a sudden, you see the hazard. People die of liver failure and so on.
And there's a problem.
But for the most part, I think on human drugs, they're doing pretty well if they keep adding protections aftermarket. That is, when it goes out into the market, you keep watching it. You make sure that when something's happening out there, you can see it immediately and pull it back.
So you don't think that the whole environment, in its sophistication, in the onrush of new subtle products, is kind of floating away from the possibility of control?
I don't think so. As long as they stick to the main point at the FDA, if they do the science and they have enough people to do the science and they follow the science and make their decisions based on what the data says, which is what they mostly do, I think they're going to be in pretty good shape. As long as when these genomics come along, for example, you have to add people on, you have to do those, you know, as a separate matter, you have to add on completely. I think they can manage it.
Philip Hiltz, it's such a pleasure to have a journalist so steeped in the subject that he can speak to it with your authority. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. I want to turn to them, if I may. David's calling from Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening.
I had an observation about your phrase nitpick or fast track.
Mm-hmm.
I've had HIV for 15 years.
Okay.
And I appreciate, I encourage fast tracking of drugs, not only for HIV, but for any disease. But what happens is after the FDA fast tracks a drug, the FDA relies on the drug company self-reporting, anecdotal reports of side effects, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the FDA needs to develop an in-house monitoring system where they do not rely on the drug companies, especially in cases of Fedra. The FDA would have found out that it's deadly much quicker, and they could also find out whether certain drugs are efficacious or non-efficacious. But right now, after they fast track, I think they need a little nitpicking in developing their own in-house monitoring system as
consumers begin to pick it up. David, your cell phone's breaking up a bit, but we thank you for your call, and I think we've got it. Philip Hiltz, here's a man with HIV. He's ready to see fast tracking, but he also wants to see monitoring after drugs are out of the starting gate. I guess there's two issues there. Take us into this issue of fast tracking first. I'm sure many ears will prick up at that point and say, wait a minute, I want drugs that are absolutely safe. On the other hand, if you have a life-threatening disease, like our caller David, you can see why you might be a little more liberal in your interpretation of what sufficient investigation is. And we hear Mark McClellan talking about fast tracking. What's the issue there?
The issue there is about how long you spend looking at the data on a drug. If it's a drug that's fairly ordinary and there are 18 different sorts out there already, it's not so urgent that you get it done immediately. On average, it takes about 12 months to get a drug out. But when you have something coming along that is new in an area, for example, the first AIDS drug, you've got to get it out immediately because there is nothing else. And so during the AIDS years, the beginnings, the AIDS activists, the early years of AIDS, had a big effect on the FDA because they went and protested and negotiated and sort of got in their face on this subject and had a big impact, so that our rules about fast tracking now are much better than they were. And for example, the AIDS drugs now typically can get out there with like 30 days, 40 days from the time they arrive.
30 days from the time the FDA first puts their hands on them until they're in the market? Is that what you mean?
That's right. That's right. 30 to 40 days. And the way they do that, of course, is they start as soon as they hear from a company that they've got something going, the FDA goes over there and follows it through the tests so that they don't have to spend the time doing that again when the actual application comes in.
So is there
a
consensus?
Very fast on not only AIDS drugs now, mm-hmm. they have done that with some cancer drugs and other drugs.
So is there a general
fast track is in place?
Yeah, that's astoundingly fast to me. Is there at this point, a general consensus about whether the FDA is, you know, crisp, efficient, and speedy in processing these things, or does it still, it at one time had a reputation, at least in the political fray, of being hopelessly bureaucratic and slow and overindulgent of its scientists? What's the current thinking, or is there a consensus between, you know, the commercial end of this and the consumer end?
Well, if the numbers are available, and it's clear that the FDA is as fast as any agency in the world, and it's also safer. The drugs that we put out, we call very few of them back because of hazards. So it's the fastest and safest now, and it has been for some time. There was a time early on when they were much slower, partly because they were inventing the rules as they went along. Nobody had ever done this before, tried to ask companies to do sophisticated clinical trials proving that a drug works and it's safe. And so the companies and the FDA had to work together to invent the system. In the 70s, it was much slower.
And what about
but then it got faster. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other problem, and that is there's a far-right conservative group that has intentionally trashed the FDA to try to knock down regulation in general. And they've told a lot of stories about the FDA that simply was not true.
I want to come back and look at those, Philip Hiltz, but I guess let's get David's other point first. It's news to me that the FDA only investigates at the starting gate. And once it's out in the market, the companies, the corporations themselves have the responsibility for tracking the effects, the efficacy of drugs. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a weak system. What it is once it's out there in the market, nobody is actually required when they have a doctor, for example, if he has a patient who has taken a drug and had a bad reaction, mm-hmm. the doctor's not required to call the FDA and tell them about it, not required to call the company and tell them about it. So it's voluntary reporting. And so because of that, you get only scattered reports when something's going on out there.
Why not make it, required reporting?
Well, I can tell you why it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. A lot of people believe there ought to be a better system. But you can imagine the doctor's reaction if you say, now every time you see anything that might be a reaction to a drug, you're going to have to start filling out some forms and sending them in. The doctors do not like this idea.
Boy, patients might well like it, though.
Yeah, and the companies, of course, they're not real happy about the idea either. If you have this massive monitoring system, you're going to be seeing a lot of things you're not seeing now, and there might be a great deal of unease about it.
Yet the faster science moves, the more consumers might like to have the FDA keeping an eye on things. Victoria's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Victoria. You're on the air.
Hello. My point is, I think one of the biggest obstacles that the FDA faces right now is the general public. I work in a research study, National Institute of Health sponsored. Mm-hmm. It's a pharmaceutical study. And we have patients coming in who will willingly and actively take a diet drug that's not FDA approved and not think about what the side effects or consequences might be. And yet we follow informed consent procedures where we're mandated to tell them every single thing that might happen to them, however unlikely, and they freak out.
So you're saying that consumers are actually too intolerant of side effects, of the rough patches that come along with medicine?
That, and they don't ask questions. They're willingly blind. They don't want to see the potential side effects, but whenever they're forced to know about them, they think that this drug that's been FDA approved for 10 years, mm-hmm. even though we tell them might cause a headache, nausea, vomiting, they freak out. Whereas if they read the potential side effects from the herbal supplements that they're taking, they're probably worse.
Got it, Victoria. Thanks for your call. Phil Hiltz, how about it? I mean, even right there on the television, we're always seeing new drugs advertised, and then there's that awful little list of side effects that comes after. Is that just inevitable, that every advantage comes with a price, potential price and side effects? Is the FDA considered, tough enough on that? Are consumers, coddled into a sense that they should never have side effects?
I don't think we do a great job of educating people about what drugs are and what kind of risks you're taking. But you also have a problem with different people have different attitudes on it. And some people want to know everything about their drugs, and other people don't want to know anything about their drugs. The doctor says, take them, they take them. Stop taking them, they stop taking them. So it's quite a variety of reactions out there. But I think probably we could do a much better job at explaining to people what the nature of drugs is.
And drugs not coming without some attendant risks, I guess,
exactly.
and yet nobody really wants to take the risks. Philip Hill, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the number one consumer protection agency in the nation, the FDA, with Philip Hiltz, author of the new book, Protecting America's Health, the FDA, Business and 100 Years of Regulation. You can join the conversation. Do you want a nitpicking FDA or a fast-tracking FDA? Do you trust what's on the label? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the FDA and practically everything that goes into your body. My guest tonight is Philip Hiltz. He's author of the new book, Protecting America's Health, the FDA, Business and 100 Years of Regulation. You can join the conversation as well. Himmick's on the line from Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Hi, Himmick. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. I am originally from the Czech Republic over in Europe.
Sure.
And it's mandatory over there that food that contains genetically modified organisms be labeled as such, and I'm wondering if the FDA is thinking about requiring something like that in the States too anytime soon.
Good question, Himmick. Thanks for your call. Philip Hiltz, how about it? We know there's been enormous pushback from Europe against American food products and a big contest in the U.S. as well. Where does that stand now on whether or not foods should be labeled when they have genetically modified material?
At the moment, the FDA doesn't want to label them. Their argument is that if the food goes into your body and it has the same effect in your body, it's tests and whatnot, they don't see any science that says there's any difference. And so until they see a difference, until they do the study that shows a difference, they don't want to label the food. It's a completely different take than what is in Europe, where everybody wants to know so they can make their own decision.
Is that in your mind, Phil Hiltz, a scientific judgment or a commercial political judgment made under pressure from a very large and strong food industry?
Right now, the judgments about GM foods are all political because we don't know much. I mean, what's probably going to happen with these foods is you'll probably see, as with any new technology, you're going to see bad effects from time to time. I suspect they're going to be in the area of the environment rather than in the body. I think you're probably going to see some environmental problems from them, but we don't know yet. We don't have the data. So you can't say it's scientific, but there is the scientific fear, the sense that something has changed. Let's study it, let's label it, is what they say in Europe. What they say here is, let's study it, let's not yet label it.
So there's always a political context, and a context in the U.S. case, which is heavily commercially colored, it would seem to me. I mean, labeling is not that hard to do.
Well, this is our country. This is what it is. It's capitalism we're talking about. We're also talking about food. Europeans care a great deal more about what they eat and the way they eat it and what it tastes like. They have troubles with McDonald's. We don't seem to have trouble with McDonald's.
We've just got a couple minutes left. I want you to give us just the nutshell version of the big attack on the FDA in the 90s. What can we learn from that? What happened there? What made it go away? Is it going to come back?
We don't know whether it's going to come back. It came from the extreme right, and it came from conservative economists whose theory is that regulation of all kinds is bad and should be done away with, period. A very simplistic kind of idea, but it drives the right. And conservatives have bought this idea. And so when we had presidents from Reagan onward, we had an attempt to knock down regulations. They cut back the FDA budgets, and eventually, when the Congress went the farthest to the right it's been in a while, when Newt Gingrich was in there, the plan was to actually dismantle the FDA, get rid of it, go back to the 19th century. They actually wrote the bills to do that. One of them passed the Senate. One was going through the House. Finally, it was moderate Republicans that stopped it, realizing that if you stop testing drugs, how are you going to explain that? They're going to have a hard time figuring out how to explain that and what happens if there's drug disasters. They'd be in big trouble. So they stopped the legislation, but the idea is still there that we should go toward deregulation. But most of the stories they would tell as they're going through, they would say, if a murderer kills you, it's homicide. And if the FDA kills you with its slowness, it's just being cautious.
Full deregulation, it's a fairly shocking idea. It sounds like shooting straight back to the beginning of the century you describe.
Yes, and the stories they told, I looked into a lot of the ones they had in their ads about this drug killed thousands of people. The stories were false. They were completely false, and you wonder where they got them from and how they got them that way, but that's what it was built out of.
Well,
that's why in the end it stopped. The moderate Republicans said, well, you know, these stories just aren't true, so we're not going to do it.
We're glad for the story you're telling. It's a fascinating one, and we thank you for sharing it with us, Philip Hiltz. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Philip Hiltz is author of Protecting America's Health, the FDA, Business, and 100 Years of Regulation. You can read the first chapter of Philip Hiltz's new book on our website at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Hollywood's treatment of epidemics. This is On Point. SARS, smallpox, West Nile virus, Ebola. It seems like almost every year a new threat of epidemic saturates our headlines and sends a shiver through the nation. The threats can be very real, but there is also something horribly irresistible about contagion. You know that. The media knows it. And Hollywood knows it. The big screen has been host to dozens of movies on apocalyptic epidemics and the creepy, panicky shivers they create. To review the movie's epidemic medical record, we're joined by our contagiously informative movie maven, Garen Daly, a film critic and artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
So why Hollywood so vulnerable to epidemic, Garen? And how far back does the vulnerability go?
Well, the reason why is simple. I mean, it has all the elements that you need for a good movie. You've got got tension, you have something that's very evil and scary and that kills people. And for a screenwriter, it's the perfect vehicle to create a nice drama about. And how far it goes back? Almost to the beginning. In my research, I saw that the first film that I recognized was in 1912. It was called Sunbeam. It was about scarlet fever. In 1915, there was a film called The Prize Baby, which was about a town being quarantined. There have been films about measles, smallpox, yellow fever, and even man-made contagions. And in 1994, Wolfgang Petersen, the guy that did Das Boot, made a film with Dustin Hoffman and Morgan Freeman called Outbreak. And in it, a man-made contagion has been released by the government. And Morgan Freeman is having some doubts about it.
1918. Remember your history, Donnie? The great influenza pandemic? Circled the globe in 9 months. Killed 25 million people.
My father lost 3 brothers in that, so?
What if there were men who could have stopped? Only they didn't. How do you think history would judge such men?
Oh, baloney. These people are Americans. 2,600 dead or dying Americans. If that bug gets out of their belly, 260 million Americans will be dead or dying. Those people are casualties of war, Billy. I would give them all a medal if I could.
Morgan Freeman and Donald Sutherland in 1994's Outbreak. And there, of course, this is supposed to be a man-made epidemic.
That's right. It's a man-made epidemic that's out of control, and they're trying to contain it, and they're having problems containing it.
But it's war.
To them, it is war because they're dealing with the biological terror that's out there, and they're trying to counteract it. I mean, in reality, though, there have been some epidemics, which they make reference to in that piece, the 1918 influenza epidemic, which if you scratch anyone's family deep enough, you'll find that somebody lost a relative. I lost a great uncle. My grandfather's brother died in 1918. And Horton Foote, who wrote Tender Mercies and To Kill a Mockingbird, did a very wonderful memoir of his family in 1918. And remarkably, it's called 1918. And the problem with the influenza epidemic of 1918 was that it was out of control. No one knew what was going on. And families and everyone was just contracting it, and they just got scared, and they never knew who was going to catch it next. And in this particular clip we're going to hear right now, it is the grandfather who has actually contracted the disease.
Your papa's come down with the flu. Mama said that's why she didn't come over with you. He's very sick, Elizabeth. You'll need some help.
Will you call Mama and tell her?
She's busy nursing your papa.
Oh, that's right. Horace is very sick.
He's very sick. I'll leave this medicine for you. Give him 2 teaspoons as soon as you get him into bed, and another one tomorrow morning.
Yes, sir, Dr. White.
And I'd keep him away from your baby if I were you.
There's Horton Foote's 1985 depiction of the 1918 influenza epidemic, and there's a kind of languid quality about that. I guess it's in Texas. It's not in the metropolitan center, but at the same time, there is always the tension that lurks in these movies and that sense of waiting for word of a medical savior, of a breakthrough. It's happening with SARS right now.
And again, you know, it's interesting that as a Western culture, we don't look for religion. We don't look for something metaphysical or mystical to come out. We look for that scientist, that person who has the knowledge to try and bring it down so that we can discover it. Our brains are going to do what this little nasty bug is not doing.
You know,
Beat back the darkness. And the typical film that Hollywood produces is these docudramas. And one of the first docudramas is the story of Louis Pasteur. He had to fight the government all the time in France to try and let him do his research so he could save the people from anthrax. And he goes to the small province. All the sheep are there and healthy because of his work. And all of a sudden, a scientist from Paris comes to kind of like look and see what's going on.
Here we have the blood of a sick animal. This time, with the anthrax bacillus present. Note the rods that occur among the cells. Those are the culprits we're fighting. At this stage, the animal is doomed to die. Once it is buried, however, the germs cease to be active and become spores again. As time goes on, they're liberated into the soil to be blown about in the dust and pollute the grass. Hence the continued recurrence of the plague.
And you say these spores are present even here, in the pastures at Arbois?
In every acre of ground that I've tested. The only reason that our cattle stay healthy is because of my vaccine. For an animal that hasn't been vaccinated, Arbois is one of the worst areas in all of France.
There Karen Daly, it sounds almost like a grade school science film, a kind of public health teaching tool, not exploiting really, but saying, here, dear audience, is how the science of this disease works.
Well, that's because our brains aren't capable of dealing with these large scientific issues, so they have to treat us like children. And it is interesting how they do treat us like children in that movie. But, you know, the thing that we need to remember about Louis Pasteur is he was fighting the government the entire time. And you would think that we would have learned that lesson, because in the 70s and in the 80s, we were faced with another epidemic, and it was the political ideology that seemed to prevent a good scientific approach to what was happening. And I'm talking about the AIDS epidemic. And in Randy Schilt's book, and the band played on, it was subsequently made into an HBO movie, they had to deal with the fact that they were underfunded, underrecognized, and that there was an epidemic that was starting to happen, and no one really knew that it was happening. And CDC, a bunch of people got together and started discussing, what exactly do they have on the table here? What is really going on with all these men dying?
It's a single infectious agent with a high probability of sexual transmission.
Well, then viral or bacterial?
Well, if you skip, think, and prove, I'd say viral, but it's only a guess.
Guess, definitely.
Okay, well, let's assume that it is a virus. Now, the question is it one that we already know that has become lethal, or is this some kind of brand new virus that we've never even seen before?
Here's a little stat to chew on. In 7 months, the number of cases jumped from 5 to 152 in 15 states.
7 months? Yeah, but the spooky part is that so far the mortality rate has been 40%.
40%?
And according to the doctors taking care of these patients, the mortality rate could ultimately turn out to be
100%. 100%.
My God.
You can hear there, Garen, how disease always disturbs the status quo. It sort of challenges interests and perspectives. There's always that oh my God moment.
Yeah, the oh my God moment is like there seems to be almost a complacency going on, and something comes along and there is this reaction of like, it's not there. The blinders go on, and it really takes something dramatic to make people totally aware that there is something very dangerous going on.
So now we're in an age where we don't know if the latest thing is SARS, a South China duck farm, or something more designed deliberately by a fiendish human hand.
Man-made contagion really haunts our fears, and like a good horror film, it's there always in the background. We're always kind of worried about it. Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, made in 1995, is a perfect example of how biological terror becomes the focus of a film. In the film, Bruce Willis and Madeline Stowe are hot on the trail of somebody who they know is going to release a contagion that is going to wipe out 5 billion people. And so they're trying to find it. And the guy is about ready to board a plane and bring his contagion to like many different places, where he gets stopped at the checkpoint where supposedly is a safety point.
Biological, check the papers. It's all proper. Take a permit.
It's empty.
Well, yes, to be sure. It looks empty. But I assure you it's not. It doesn't even have an odor.
That's not necessary, sir. There you go. Thank you for your cooperation. Have a good flight.
In both its natural origin and in this new kind of notion of the terrorist-transmitted disease, this sounds like an absolutely evergreen theme for Hollywood, the epidemic.
Yeah, it is, and they will continually mine it for what it's worth, because it does offer all the tension, all the fear. It's like a horror movie, but it strikes very, very close to home, because we know in the back of our minds that the possibility is always there. And when you do a Hollywood horror film, the possibility that it's there is the scariest thing.
Garen Daly, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Garen Daly is film critic and artistic director of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.